You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord server stage talk titled Researching the Troubled Teen Industry. In a slightly different approach this week, the speaker of this talk hasn't published their work publicly yet. Alison Jenkins, a Bellingcat Discord member, reached out to ask if she could speak about her work covering the troubled teen industry in the hope that other researchers listening to the talk may want to get involved in her project. If you do listen to this and want to get involved, join the Bellingcat Discord server. You can find links to all the resources mentioned in the description of this podcast. Alison spoke on her database that she's built covering data from institutions and courts, but also to her own understanding of the industry and how it functions, having been sent to a TTI institution as a youth. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday the 11th of April in the Bellingcat Discord server. Welcome! Today, Alison Jenkins, aka a troublemaker in the Discord server, is here to talk about researching the troubled teen industry using open source techniques. Alison is an open source researcher with lived experience of the troubled teen industry and has spent years creating a database that collects public data on the institutions and companies in the industry into one central place. The database is currently not public, but in production. We'll explain how you can get in contact with Alison during the talk in case you'd like to learn more about how to get involved with the project. Alison will be taking your questions later in the hour, so please write all of your questions in the chat as she's talking, and I'll ask them once we get into the Q&A section of the talk. But first, Alison is going to explain why it's worth looking into the troubled teen industry, why open source research techniques are useful for investigations into this space, and we mean really useful, and what she's done so far with the data collection. Alison, please take the mic.
All right.
What am I on to? All right. So, hi, I'm Alison, otherwise known as a troubled maker. You can now see the association with the play on words there, considering what it is that I dig around in. But this is essentially my main area of focus, and I didn't even know what OSINT was upon the time that I roughly before I started this, and then other things that kind of led up to me being really aware of what ways I could, you know, be able to collect information and kind of connect the dots, as it were. So what is the troubled teen industry and why should you care? And also, why haven't you probably heard of it? And as I'm assuming probably half of the audience here, or maybe just kind of in Bellingcat as a whole, might be European based. I know that it's not many are from the U.S. as far as I can tell. And this is something that's pretty central to the U.S. And so something that I'll kind of share, and maybe you can help with this a bit, Charlie, is this is the article that I point people to when I start to explain what this is about. Essentially for decades, and I mean since like the early 60s, there has been a private, unregulated industry in the United States that has no federal oversight whatsoever. It's all generally left up to the state, if they do anything at all. And it's basically, we'll fix your kid and buy whatever they present to you. Whether that's something they actually do, whether that's something that actually works, there's no data on that. And the data that you do find, you realize, is given and produced by groups within this industry. It's pretty multifaceted. Now, in this article that I've linked to, they usually get, and this is a very good one by Maya Salovitz, who's continued to do work on covering the troubled teen industry. It originates with a cult called Synanon. That's where everything is kind of branched out. And from there, it kind of went towards drug rehab programs and then into more of the therapeutic boarding school or residential programs, which then covers wilderness, boot camps, and a variety of other things. But there's nothing collectively to put it all together. There's no really agreed upon definition. So it gets really complicated there. Now, my own personal experience is about two decades ago, but it was only until maybe
5 years ago, less than that, maybe, that I started to kind of become aware of things. And interestingly, what it was that did that, and I always worry about pronouncing this correctly, but it was a particular data project on the Uyghur re-education camps. And when I saw this, and then saw that it, at least something that presented it, that it was really rooted in a lot of at least OSINT methods that appeared to me at the time, I'm like, this might be an answer that is being discussed, at least so far as what really put the discussion of TTI on the map. And that was the congressional hearings that were in 2007 and 2008. So a lot of small and not very viewed videos of that online on like YouTube. And that's where, and I've watched probably the total sum of that is like 5 hours of congressional hearings. And I hate to say how many times I've watched that over and over. It's not light viewing, but I had to become very familiar with it because that's the only time it's ever gone to Congress. That's the only time it's ever been discussed. And in it, it's led by former California Senator. This is not the time I need to forget his name. George Miller, along with a few other individuals that were both surprised that this was a thing. And this was in 2007. It had been happening for quite some time already. And what's addressed and brought up in this is the fact that there's no kind of central clearinghouse. There's no centralized database. There's no data collection that happens at a federal level to bring awareness to how, you know, what this even is. You can't, I mean, there's a question that it's dark and brought up, but that a congressman asked that's, so how many deaths have occurred in this industry? And it's just silence because nobody can answer. There's no way that anybody can answer. Like, and I'm like, that's, that can be figured out to some extent. And so then I'm like, I could probably give a rough estimate. Like there's a way to kind of put that together, especially now with how often it's being covered. And with that said, in the past few years, especially with in about late 2020, is when it started to get a lot of traction media wise. And that was largely in part due to a documentary, Uyghur, got it. Thank you. That was largely in part due to someone coming out with a documentary and mentioning that they attended one of these facilities. That was Paris Hilton. And that was centered around Provo Canyon, which is definitely a root of where a lot of this started. That's based out of Utah. And the reason why it's so significant is because it's what allowed so many other of the people that started this, were key parts in this industry to be able to continue and form their own off of it. So that's kind of how it's existed. And it's been in states where there's, you'll notice that it exists in states, like particular ones, notably Utah, Idaho, Montana, places that are in the middle of nowhere, strangely North Carolina, and then some states that were somewhat quite religious. And that was usually due to a religious exemption for them, in which if it were associated with probably what you would refer to as fundamentalist baptism or independent fundamentalist Baptist is the term, our IFB. You could start a rehabilitation school and not let anyone know. You could open it in your basement. You could say, I got sweet baby Jesus here. He's going to help sort out your kid in case you think they're doing drugs. $4,000 a month. you could do that. That was a thing until like 2021. And that's because it got, and it took a lot for that to get exposed. And so I'm like, we need to just get this information out there. And I'm only limited in so much in what I can do. But from years of being what I referred to as an ethically nosy person, I kind of put that all together and I'm like, wait, I can link all this. And so I tested it. I tested it on a in a few ways, but in actual lawsuits. One of them, which was very familiar to me already, and then a few others that weren't. And it turned out to have positive results. And everything that I've put together has been basically things that I've collected, even though I've put there invited people to submit things that hasn't really been able to happen yet. But I guess kind of onwards to the process of how I went about doing this. So there is a sort of process that I went through of like, okay, I've defined the problem here. Clearly, there's no central information. If you type in troubled teen industry as is on your preferred search engine, you're going to get marketing sites. They're not going to be objective. And also I recognize the issue that I'm going to struggle being objective. So I need to, at some point in this process, have a lot of feedback and a lot of participation from other people. So to kind of go through what this is all about. And also to make sure I'm explaining it clearly, because that's been something I've been hit with quite a bit. So what I started doing was, I'm like, okay, I'm going to start just kind of anything that seems related, I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it and then start kind of building that, organizational process as I go. And what I noticed was there was a distinct difference in being able to put together the directory aspect, which is basically each facility, past and present, who's been involved with it, their credentials, that kind of stuff. Stuff that you would think would be easy to find and check, but aren't. Because there's no requirement for it. You can, though, but it requires somebody that can do a lot of digging. And so I put all of, I was like, okay, what all needs to, let's say that there's a directory listing page on all of these facilities. What would be listed on it? And from some of those congressional hearings that I mentioned before, they talked about what would be appropriate to have on there. What's the person's training? Have they had a background check? Because there's a lot of places that don't require that. Even still today, it's of, oh, if they're not directly near the children, do we need to have that? I'm like, that's still a question. So I've put all that together, being able to answer, how many beds are there, rather how many children do they allow to have, whether it's small, like 10 to 15, upwards of a few hundred, and how many, what their violation reports are, all that kind of stuff, everything that is as close to objective as it could possibly be by the numbers and things you can sort. One of the things I did for one particular facility was because of having all of its police record, like police records that were to the address of it, is from 1999 to 2019, being able to view a chart of how many runaways there were, or just how many records in general, I believe, and just being able to visually see that. I do see a question that I have to answer. It keeps coming up. What's considered a troubled teen? Whatever your parent thinks is a troubled teen. There's no due process. There is no board of, troublesome kids association. That doesn't exist. It's all you have to do is be a parent that is either annoyed, upset, or worried. And actually, the more vulnerable you are as a parent that is genuinely worried, and if they had the full information, would not sign on to this, are probably the most targeted and the most vulnerable. And that's one of the reasons why I don't hold much towards these parents, a lot of them. Whereas there are a lot of survivors that might, and that's completely understandable. But the thing is, the parents are targeted specifically because they're in a vulnerable state. And a lot of them are really concerned about their child. But this is a very predatory nature. They're not caring about helping the kid. They're caring about how much money this is bringing in. And hence the focus on billion-dollar industry. It is incredibly lucrative. So yeah, I hope that answers the question. The term troubled, that doesn't really matter. It's just whatever parent will send whom where, I guess. You could just be depressed. That's it. So yeah, hopefully that kind of clears that part up, because I noticed it was coming up a lot. And that's another thing. These can also be, at least it used to happen more so, I know of it happening a little bit more recently, is that these can be court ordered. That's the scary part. There's a little bit of an overlap in it being full, like completely private, and then it being a part of the family court system, which is its own big mess. They'll often, if a youth is arrested for, let's say, petty theft or something, and they're facing some kind of jail time, they may be given the option to attend one of these facilities, and not knowing any better, and their parents not knowing any better, may pick that. So that does happen, and it ends up, you know, retrospectively for many being a lot worse. But to get kind of back on track of how I've put together a lot of this is, I realized that the information needed to be handled in two different ways. Because there was a lot of material that wasn't specific to facilities and programs and the people that worked in them, but was helpful in understanding how they operated. Hence the name Industry of Programs and Practices for Youth Treatment. It's the program and the practice, because there's overlap in the practices that can happen at multiple programs, and then the programs themselves are interrelated. So for the programs part, and this is what's been the most difficult for me, mainly because it's involved SQL, is building a database with that because of the relational component, so that you're able to see if a person who is running a program has run one before under another name, you'll be able to see that, because they're going to deliberately hide that. There have been individuals who have been in this industry for years and have gone unchecked because of the fact that people can't easily connect those dots. And, you know, I and others have. It's just not been easy to show. And then the reference part, which is kind of more like a browsable sort of library of resources, focuses more on the studies, the academics, the, you know, explaining, I guess, kind of the effects of long-term effects of, you know, solitary confinement, which is something that is a practice in the troubled teen industry. Solitary and isolation, those are very much a practice, and they can be called different names, such as like ISO or introspection. They'll really dress it up. And it's not, it's solitary confinement, plain and simple. Like, oh, they need time to think to themselves. I'm like, no, that's okay. So to be able to understand that, like, I'll even kind of, the way that I have all of this kind of sorted out is by the directory and then the reference library. And then the reference library, it's articles and news, digital media, which is all a bunch of videos, industry orgs, which it's important for this industry to stay afloat by being, you know, talked about positively by somebody. And so that's where these industry organizations come into play. One of the key ones is called NatZap. And that's because its fusion has existed for probably, yeah, as long back as that I have had my own personal experience of this industry. It's existed for quite some time. All the people that run it, though, run programs. So it's not particularly objective. And then everything that's been related to legislative action and efforts, all of the bills that have been passed. If you guys wanted to even take a look later at some of this information, there's a thread that I started that talks about some of this and gives kind of an idea into a glimpse there of what I'm referring to. Also, research guides, things that are from, the National Institute of Justice, that kind of thing, trainings, and the directory all has it divided down by state and then by each facility. And then the way that data can be explored based on the type of database infrastructure that works best for it, which is what I found so far to be the case. As far as being able to kind of test the, potential for positive, progress and positive outcome, I've been able to take information that has already existed and then information that could be later added to it to work on several civil cases, at least, and provide that with either significantly advancing the case or either preventing it from being dismissed early. And that was the last one was definitely difficult. And that's where that was around the time that I entered the hackathon last year. And that was based on part of the issues that I was having in having the attorneys I was working with understand and be able to go through what I was giving them more, like a bit quicker. And for it to be something that they could see and it not terrify them. So I'm like, yeah, they're going to see GitHub and run. So we got to make this look familiar. But yeah, there's a lot that I've already put together. It's just that I'm adamant about this being as high a quality possible. And that's also why I've kind of come to, learning about Bellingcat over the years, interacting and everything. Because some of the people that I've met that have been the most, that have been provided so much help to me have been people that I met directly through Bellingcat. The people that, for example, that helped me with creating ArchiveEye. Danny is brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And he was also somebody that kind of from a different angle was able to understand what I was talking about. He's originally from China. And he was even telling me and sent me a few articles about how even China thought that because they had some of these programs mainly for internet addiction and weight loss, and they were shut down after 5 years. So I was like, even China thought that was messed up and shut that down after 5 years. Yet here we are decades later in the United States, and we still have places that are being referred to as Gitmo for kids. Like, it's so absurd, it almost seems comical, So, and that's part of been the difficulty in people coming forward is it doesn't seem real. It doesn't. But it's been very, seeing the recognition in it and seeing the coverage has been obviously incredibly helpful, but the ability to combine all that effort and work together has been very difficult, unfortunately. And so that's what I'm hoping to make happen and to get people involved that aren't survivors of this or have, you know, specifically lived experience that can add to this and, you know, help with being able to say, you know, what would work better based on what I've been able to find and don't know if other tools exist. So I think that that's a good initial stopping point. I might, somebody might be able to bring up something else that can, of a point that I've missed, but I think that about covers it. I also see a few questions, so take it away.
Thank you so much, Alison. And can I just say, thank you so much for talking on a subject that you have lived experience on, because it is incredibly difficult to talk about your own research, but it's even more difficult if you also have lived experience of the thing that you're researching. So thank you so much for taking the time out to talk us through not only the research project that you're working on, but also some of the background to it as well. We've had lots of questions in, and please do continue to put questions in the chat. I am monitoring it and keeping a note of what you've asked. But I wanted to ask first and foremost, myself, how far do your current, to the records that you've actually collected so far, how far do they go back? And what methods are you taking to collect that data? Perhaps you can talk a little bit about that. Thanks.
So some of the earliest records that I have are from the 60s. And that's from newspaper clippings. And it regards Cenadon. There could be stuff that's even earlier than that, but that specifically relates to a program. And I remember the headline being, Dope Clinic opens in Los Angeles County. It was really... But it's this like really just old, yeah, all these old articles and everything. There's also all the FBI files that are on Cenadon, because that was later investigated to be a cult. Like, that's not just throwing that term around. That's what it was ruled as such. They go pretty far back. And getting that kind of, because this goes beyond just digital stuff oftentimes, because a lot of this existed before there was digital stuff. So yeah, that would be it, probably around that.
And how are you collecting the data itself? I think you mentioned to me before that you've had to use public records and things like that, public record requests. Can you talk us through a little
bit? Yeah, so by the way, those of you not in the United States, FOIA requests aren't free. The freedom is to the information if you can afford it. That's what's been really difficult about continuing to do this as somebody that doesn't have a continual budget. And so if you want to get one of the places, or a couple of places that I'll request records from, will be a State Department of Health and Human Services, or that includes Child Protective Services, something like that. Usually for Child Protective Services, you have to have you've got to have an attorney or like more of a reason or be involved. But with the Health and Human Services, it's not quite as strict. And for, let's say, take Utah, for example, they'll have something called DOPL, which is the Department of Professional Licensing. That's what you're looking for getting people, you know, seeing if they're actually licensed or able to practice. But then what you'll realize is that when you get down to a particular, like, really small level, there's tons of FOIA barriers. Yeah. Oh yeah. The big one is financial. And then it depends on the region that you're at. And if they want to, make it a deterrent for you to get those records, because they can just throw a price out at you without you knowing what it covers. And I've gotten as much as $1,250 And fortunately, at the time I was working with someone to which budget wasn't such a problem, is which she responded, okay, and who do I make that check out to? And they were just like, oh, shit. She called us out kind of. And they're like, oh, do you want it digital? That's like not as much. And so regardless, we got, but then when they sent them to us, I had to, it was like this watered up, think about it, like a watered up, just crumpled up piece of crap. I just had to tear it apart and see what was in it. It wasn't organized at all. And so that kind of gave me the insight. Maybe part of the reason why they aren't noticing this stuff is because the way they're keeping their records and tracking it is a nightmare. So that was weird, some lived experience. So yeah, the price deterrent, and if they're even going to want to give you the records in the first place, and then the way that you're supposed to request them. Yeah, all of that is incredibly difficult.
Thank you so much for that insight. A couple of people have asked about the nature of the network. So somebody asked, are these facilities also formally and publicly linked to each other? And then Lottie S says, does the TT industry have international tentacles? Have they spread to other countries? So are these facilities publicly linked to each other? And then similarly, have they kind of spread abroad as well? Do you see, have you got any records from outside of the States?
So the first one is, are they publicly linked? Yes and no. There are some that will say, you know, oh, we have a facility in this other state, like our other place, completely across the country for your convenience. Like they'll kind of do that move. But it'll usually just be like a few programs, or they'll have it where each one kind of addresses a different thing. Like one of them might be for young boys. One of them might be for those that are transitioning like into adulthood and like are kind of getting into different housing or something. Like it might just be addressing different things. Now, previously, that was not the case. And it kind of can still continue to be as such. When they've tried to extend them outside of the country, that has not gone well. And that's typically down to what's referred to as WASP, which is the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, which the last one I think was finally shut down in 2019. And those have had a extensive, if you were to look up like on YouTube or whatever, Troubled Teen Industry or something like that, or WASP just as WWASP, you'll see coverage of these facilities from like the UK did a better job initially of covering this stuff. Now, these videos are very hard to watch. I'll warn you of that. But yeah, they tried to open it in Costa Rica, Samoa, Jamaica, Mexico. And I think that's it. They tried to open in the Czech Republic. That did not last well, like long at all. That was like 6 months. And they're like, yeah, get out. whereas the other ones, it took a lot longer of an investigation, of which I have the cables for. That was fun to learn about.
My colleague Meryl has been asking a couple of questions about the media coverage, because you mentioned that in recent years, it's kind of the media coverage has gone up on this particular topic. How has she's asked, how has the media coverage, for example, the Paris Hilton documentary on the Troubled Teen industry, how has that impacted the availability of sources and the quality of them as well?
I would be interested in knowing that also. What I can say is that there's been this odd kind of reaction from both survivors and maybe kind of some other people, in that data seems to be viewed as this thing that is not democratized and that someone just suddenly owns. And I've had to explain to a few people that, you know, I'm just collecting things in one place to be able to draw connections. I'm not trying to hoard information. I'm not trying to, and, you know, and what I'm getting is typically from, you know, things that have existed for quite some time, but have never been explored and analyzed in a way that would produce usable information, such as the how many deaths have occurred, how many programs exist, that sort of stuff. Like, I'm not about just continually sharing news stories about another kid missing, another kid dead. It needs to be, this is what the industry looks like. This is what it has looked like over time. Here's how you connect things. Here's where you look. It's kind of the whole premise of what, you know, insofar as what I understand Bellingcat to be about in the first place, is by teaching people, this is how we found this, you know, information. This is how you look for it. The whole concept of, you know, of being able to show people how to do that, because ultimately it's going to be parents that are, and it's going to be parents that may not be that tech savvy. So that's what I'm keeping in mind, is they're first seeing the marketing material that is issued by the facility. They're going to tell the parent whatever they want to hear to get money. They're not going to say, oh yeah, we had so many inspections last year, we failed this many, you know, whereas there needs to be that available and in a centralized place for parents to be able to look at, and, you know, especially that are in a vulnerable position where they're worried about their child. And then they're being told by these same places, well, if you don't send your kid here, they're going to end up addicted to drugs, in jail, or dead.
And I noted that in your project, you're trying to do that education model, right? You're explaining on the database website that's kind of in production at the moment that you've shown me. It's you've got a section all on kind of how open source is helping here and kind of what that means and how it can assist in this particular space. Mm-hmm. Is it as easy as teaching kind of individuals where to look, or is it actually difficult to find that information online? And is everything kind of, does everything have to involve kind of public record requests, or is there spaces online where you can kind of easily access this kind of, these kinds of reports that you're talking about?
It's not easy at all. It's unfortunately very, very difficult. There was a few years ago, the Salt Lake Tribune, they had to do a fundraiser to collect the records for the state of Utah. Like, it was about $5,000, I believe, to be able to get those. And that's been a source of some of what I have as well. And the thing is that even it was a church. And the thing that kind of helps having more of the technical perspective is whenever I saw the way that they were keeping these records, I could tell that it was the back end of a database because there's parameter fields. I'm like, is this what they're keeping? And then I could tell that there were ones that were clearly just written up in Microsoft Word. They had no, like, nothing to fill in, anything like that. So I saw that and I'm like, oh no. But then what you could potentially extrapolate from it when you're able to parse through all of that information is still incredibly alarming, but it's really hard to even get to. And then on top of that, how it's being done is appalling. Like, there should be some kind of, you know, easier system or way to check through these kinds of things. No, they're just using Word.
Yeah, so there's no standardization whatsoever. Somebody asked, actually, Jane asked in the comments, because you mentioned that you were really, when you first started looking into this, you were really surprised, for example, that they weren't tracking the number of deaths. Jane asked, in your research in tracking deaths in the industry, what have you noticed?
That they still happen. unfortunately. I know that that's a weird way to answer that question. The best thing that to be able to kind of give an idea of that, and really one of the best resources that I can, share on that specifically are the GAO reports. And initially, a lot of those were done around the congressional hearings. And those have some pretty, I guess, for lack of a better term, potent findings in being able to establish how many unreported cases of abuse, torture, and death had occurred by that point. And it was in the thousands. And by that, they mean that, you know, there were no convictions for these either. No one was reprimanded. Like, if at much at the most, it was a slap on the wrist or maybe a fine, but the place wasn't shut down. It's just that's why the quote comes from that I have on the even just now existing instance of the IPID index is. So you mean to tell me that murder is okay now? Because that's what's happening.
So we've mentioned the deaths that are occurring in some of these institutions. What other kind of data are you collecting? What is out there? For example, can you find why people have been sent to these institutions? Is that kind of data collected? Can you see how many people are actively at these institutions at the same time? What kind of metrics, what kind of data are you finding other than kind of the worst case scenario elements in terms of the deaths and the ones that have like ended up into court cases?
Sure. So there is a way to kind of figure out how many might be at a facility or even collectively in that state at one time, presuming that you have found all of them in one state. So let's say you take a state that doesn't have very many. If I were to think off the top of my head of one of those, Nebraska, because there's not much in Nebraska to begin with. So let's use that. So that's going to be easier to kind of figure out. That's only going to probably have a few places at most. So the ability to determine how many it would be, how many beds they have. And then at a given time, probably presume that all those beds are filled because usually they are. It's really hard to find a place where they're not. And then if that continues, then that's kind of your baseline. And there's a few ways that you can cross-reference that as well. I mean, you can call and ask them. They'll tell you. They're not going to see that as harmful. Like, so there's you could even end up, and I've considered this for some time, you could like request and they will send you all kinds of, you know, pamphlets, booklets, everything, all of their marketing material. Because I remember right before I was sent away, all that stuff kept popping up in the mail. I'm like, is this? And I'd read through it and I'm like, well, it's not like the sticks of Louisiana. So that almost sold me on it alone. But I mean, I was just like, there's a pool at a spa. Nah, that's a lie. it's been what I refer to as a friend, because I have to, one of the things that helps me kind of get through this, digging into it is, I have to take a little bit of a sense of humor with it. And I've often thought about just, my friend's like, yeah, it's hard looking just at another picture of another sad boy on a horse. Yeah, it is. Cause that's what you see. You just see all these kids on horses because ranches are very popular in the TTI. They're something that, I don't know what it is about equine therapy, but apparently that's just a big deal. Yeah. I hope I covered that well.
Yeah. I think, there's kind of this, misleading, assumption that in America, the, TTI industry is only kind of the wilderness camps that you might have seen, for example, in some of the Netflix documentaries, but actually it spans into lots of different institutions, right? From like boarding schools to wilderness camps to, as you mentioned, kind of these ranches. CR asks, because of the lack of standardized data you ran into, what was your thought process on how to organize that as you researched and the best way to archive your findings?
Well, I mean, as I would go from state to state and see the different ways that they would have that data made available, I would notice that there were some states that did it exceptionally better than others, and that were even possibly an example for other states that, you know, that did it. And I also noticed that those were the states that appeared to not have a bad record of this being, you know, in their history. So they really didn't have much to hide potentially. But yeah, there are some states that actually do a pretty good job at it. And then there are some where it's just like, who's at the computer? Like, who's typing? And yeah, so it differed from each one. And I was really curious about that as well. I wanted to see how each state handled it. And so I have a list, and also I used to have all of the links to each different one of, because for every state, there's a different department, a different place, a different thing. And again, I stress, as a parent, how are you going to know that? Because these are all, most of this is reliant on being sent out of state, even though there is so much research that says to the contrary. The more the kind of help and assistance that's going to be more effective, it's going to be within one's own community, like full stop. Sending your kid, your child away and not having communication with them and not, you know, being a part of that process directly is the least helpful thing that's going to happen. But these places are going to tell you otherwise. And they're not going to link to any sources on that.
Yeah, the pamphlets and leaflets, as you mentioned, are worth almost studying alone. Lottie S has asked, and this is actually a question that I had too. Can you talk about the people lobbying on behalf of the industry against regulations and stuff? Have you found interesting things on them? Do you often look at records of kind of these lobbying groups and how they operate? And those things that you've been collecting as part of your research as well?
For those of you who can see my face, might answer that question. But for those that can't, yes, there are. And I don't want to get too into it right now. But here's what I'll say is that whenever you see an organization and you see 501c something, right? When you see 501c3, usually that represents like a charity, the typical kind of nonprofit that you would think of, or we don't have the term NGO in the United States, really. I haven't really heard that until I started speaking to a lot of Australians. I don't know, but so you won't find that there, but then you'll see also the number at the end means something. When you see 501c6, that's a lobbying organization. That's something very different. Those, you know, there's a few of them, and the way that they're presented is incredibly misleading to the majority of people. Now, when you have someone like me who from a young age realized when you right click on a page, it shows you how it was put together and how it works, I still do that. And if I want to, you know, figure out, okay, that doesn't look right. Where is that from? And then just digging further into it, you'll realize that some of the vast majority of these groups, I would say every single one that I've come across, are run by the very people who are running the facilities themselves.
We've got about 10 minutes left, so please get your questions in. Cargo Cult Scientist has said, did I get this right? Did you find that the industry is data brokering in a way? If you express interest in a program, will you get contacted by other organizations as well?
That used to happen. Yes. I don't know how
common that is to happen now. What will end up being the case is that there's something called independent educational consultant or ed consultant, really. And they are who passes along your information to see which school is the best fit, as it were. So how much of that data right at this time is still used? I don't know. There's a way that I can check on that firsthand. When I'm able to actually work one-on-one with people, it's usually the parents, who are just flustered and angry, and other survivors won't talk to them, which I think is terrible, but they were conned as well. And now they realize that they're just what happened to their child is like the last thing that they wanted to happen. And they're very angry, and upset. And, they'll usually end up telling me that they've met with some kind of educational consultant. And while usually the purpose of that is to help find somebody get into like a prep school or like a boarding school to get into like a better college or to prepare for college with like testing and such, that extends into this industry. And so then it starts off with, you know, learning disabilities or, you know, that sort of thing. Do they have ADD, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll get into, do they have behavioral? And then it starts to kind of whittle down to, oh, are they problematic? Are they troubled? And then they're thinking in their head, cool, I get that kickback. Because that's been a thing. One of the things I collected was actually it looked like a coupon for people that referred other children to these programs. They got a kickback as a person. And I'm just like, that's blatant. There is kind of a form of that, though. They'll pass that around. Or even some of the, you know how you'll see at the bottom of like a website, it'll come up and be like, chat with one of our specialists now. They'll have that on a lot of the like TTI marketing sites. It's all going to the same person.
KJW asked earlier, and by the way, we'll wrap in a second. So I think last final questions now. KJW asked earlier, when a court ordered option becomes abusive, is the court generally notified? So people are sent to those to the industry via the court, is there a little bit more regulation there? Do you find records by the court kind of checking up on that child or that teenager in your research, or is it still kind of treated the same as an individual case and who's kind of voluntarily there?
There have been judges who have been called out for that kind of thing, information that I have regarding that is mostly related to WASP facilities, because those are the ones that I can find that being kind of a repeated sort of thing. So there have been some judges called out for that. Now, if that has continued, and it has, it's just not as easy for me to find now. It's going to be within the family court system. That's where it's going to be ordered. So it's finding where that happens. And usually you'll be able to see where there's a commonality and then who was involved. And by that alone, I've been able to kind of have a few different names of judges that I've realized have some proclivity to offering that as an option. Whereas otherwise it would seem kind of bizarre.
I wanted to finally ask how you would like people listening to this recording or listening live right now, what kind of help you're hoping to get from other researchers or organizations to help you with this project? Kind of what do you need to kind of finish, jump over the finish line with this project? And what kind of support could other people offer you, and how might they get in touch with you?
Part of that is I will say that this has probably been the first time I've able to be to have publicly spoken about this work at all. So that alone has probably been the most significant thing that's been able to happen for me. And I have to say, getting a little mushy here, I am incredibly thankful for that. It's very difficult as a single person to be able to do this. And it's not for lack of trying that I haven't been able to work with others on this. Being taken seriously, it's really difficult when you're somebody that's entirely self-taught because of your circumstances or what have you. And because, you know, it's been your way of figuring out things and accomplishing a sense of justice. People don't take you seriously. And I've grown used to that, but that's unfortunate. And I would really like for that to not continue happening, to realize maybe she's onto something. She was there. And somehow she's still kind of functional. I think maybe she has something to add here. And the fact that I've continued to learn how to do, I mean, I sat down and read a book about SQL. That's dedication. That was not my interest, but I wanted to have this work. I wanted this to be accessible, but also what's been difficult is it's put a target on me. And not in a way that you would think. And I don't know what it is. Somebody suggested the term to me, which I think is Australian, is a tall poppy syndrome. And I'm like, in the brief time I took to look that up, I was like, that kind of checks. But it's also been, you know, when you have a rough life, you have to kind of develop a pretty tough exterior that might come off as intimidating to people. And in no way do I ever mean that. And it's unfortunate that that has been the case, but that's also what it's taken for me to get to this point. And if I have, I'm going to continue doing my best to use that for as positive of a way that I can, because I don't know that most of the people could have gotten this far with some of the situations and circumstances I've had.
It's very admirable. Somebody put in the chat, love your resilience. That was truly inspiring.
Thank you.
If people are interested in helping you in any form, perhaps they themselves are really interested in diving deeper into the subject, having listened to your talk. Are you comfortable with people kind of conversing with you on the thread in the Discord server and reaching out to you via that?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a great start. And then hopefully moving that towards the page whenever I'm able to safely make sure that everything runs okay and that it's secure and can't be harmed, because that's a worry of mine right now. That's why people haven't seen things publicly, is because a lot of it gets attacked. So it's got to be a step-by-step thing, but the, you know, being heard has been the necessary first step and one of the most significant, and I'm glad that it happened.
Awesome. Hypnotoe says, glad you found a place here in Bellingcat community where your work is appreciated and taken seriously. I couldn't echo that enough. I'm going to have to wrap the talk there, but thank you so much, Alison, aka a Troublemaker, for giving such a fabulous explanation to the troubled teen industry and your research. I can't wait to see it develop further, especially with the support in here. And similarly, if you're listening and you're a Bellingcat Discord member and you're thinking about, oh, I have a project that I'm working on that I'd like some support on, or I want to kind of shout about, please get in touch with me. We're really happy to give you a platform to speak about that project as well in the stage talk. So please do reach out via this Discord server and to me. Thank you again, Alison, and thank you for everyone attending.
Thank you for listening to the stage talk. If you'd like to catch a stage talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.